Welcome to Barnes & Noble Audio's Portable Professor Series, a collection of exciting and informative lectures taught by today's most distinguished college and university professors. Today we begin a course entitled Questions of Faith, the Philosophy of Religion. Your professor is Peter Kraft, a professor of philosophy at Boston College. Professor Kraft has written more than 40 books, including Fundamentals of the Faith, The Best Things in Life, Back to Virtue, Socratic Logic, Ecumenical Jihad, and Summa of the Summa. He received his bachelor's degree from Calvin College and his Ph.D. from Fordham University. Professor Kraft has been at Boston College for 40 years. Through the ages, mankind has been fascinated by questions that fall outside the realm of daily experience. Is there a God? How can we explain the presence of evil? Do humans or human souls live on after death? Is there a hell? The following lectures examine these eternal questions and present the most compelling arguments for and against God's existence. We'll also explore the seeming conflicts between religion and science, and the different truth claims of the world's most popular religions. Most importantly, we'll try to discover the best way to pursue questions of faith, as we investigate why religion has played such a critical role in human experience. And now we begin Questions of Faith, the Philosophy of Religion. Lecture 1. What is religion? Why is it worth thinking about? And now, Professor Kraft.
What is the philosophy of religion?
Religion is, as we've said, to most people, the most important thing in life. And philosophy, which means literally the love of wisdom, tries to think about the most important things in life. Therefore, philosophers naturally think about religion. But philosophy is done by reason, by logic, while all the religions of the world depend on some kind of faith. And faith means believing something you can't prove. Philosophy and religion use different methods. Yet philosophy and religion investigate many of the same questions. Like, is there a God? Is there a soul? What is the ultimate point and purpose of our lives? What is our greatest good? What is happiness? Where did we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? Why do we suffer? Why do we die? What happens after death? How should we live? These are the most important questions we've ever asked, and both philosophies and religions ask them. But why do we need to philosophize about religion? Because the more important the questions are, the more difficult they are to get clarity and certainty about. Perhaps this means we will have to end with skepticism about them if we are honest and humble enough, and perhaps not. But we'd better not begin as skeptics and assume at the outset that we can never find the truth about such things. That would be dogmatic skepticism. If we want to do philosophy, we should be skeptical skeptics, not dogmatic skeptics. We should be skeptical of everything, even skepticism. We should keep an open mind about everything, even about keeping an open mind. As Chesterton said, an open mind is like an open mouth. It needs to be opened because it needs to be filled. Religions claim to fill that mind with true food. Philosophy of religion investigates that claim. It investigates what the food is, what it means, and whether it's edible, whether it's true. To put it in a different image, religion is like an advertisement and we are like consumers. The product claims to be the meaning of life, and the price is the allegiance of your mind and your soul. So you'd better ask the salespeople some searching questions about the product before you decide to buy it or not to buy it. Or to use a still different analogy, you are Juliet and religion is Romeo's proposal to elope. You'd better get to know Romeo before you go away with him. Or turn him down. Well, if we're going to be philosophical, we need to be logical. And if we're going to be logical, we need to start with definitions. That's what Socrates always did. A definition tells us the nature of the thing, the essence of the thing, what the thing is. If you don't know what it is, you don't really know anything else about it because you don't know what you're talking about. The basic logical rule for a good definition is that it's not too narrow and not too broad. If it's too narrow, it doesn't cover all the instances of the thing it's trying to define, and if it's too broad, it doesn't clearly distinguish that thing from all other things. But when we try to define religion, we find it surprisingly difficult. We almost always give too narrow a definition, like faith in God and life after death, which doesn't cover Buddhism, Taoism, or Confucianism, or else the definition is too broad, like an answer to life's ultimate questions, which doesn't distinguish religion from atheism, Marxism, materialism, or secular humanism. Perhaps religion is one of those things that are so basic and so close to us that we can't define them, like the concept of the self, or time, or life, or being, or art. Even though we can't define them, we all know how to use these words correctly. You must have known something about what religion is, otherwise you wouldn't have bought this series of lectures. So, instead of beginning with a definition, let's begin with what we all know but can't formulate clearly. Well, why did I waste your time talking about defining religion, then, if I can't do it? To show you that you can't either. To teach you lesson one, that we all know much less than we think we know. To give you a sense of mystery, of the smallness of our minds and the bigness of the questions. Because I think without that sense, there never would have been any religion or any philosophy either. That sense is wonder, the feeling of a very small child in a very large, mysterious, and interesting house. Philosophy begins in wonder, said Socrates, and Plato, and Aristotle. So does religion. The two kinds of wonder are different, of course. Religion's wonder is more mystical, more adoring. Philosophy's wonder is more curious, more questioning. But they both begin in wonder. Perhaps it's not so bad that we can't define religion in general, because most people aren't that interested in the definition of religion in general. They're more interested in particular claims of particular religions, just as a lover is more interested in his particular beloved than in a general definition of love. Only philosophers and scientists are more interested in the abstract than the concrete. Like the philosopher who died and met God and God offered him a choice, he could go to heaven or he could go to a lecture on the concept of heaven, so he chose the lecture. Well, I'm a philosopher, and yet I laugh at that joke with you, which shows that I'm a human being before I'm a philosopher, and that not all philosophers are fools. We find a problem about method as well as a problem about definitions. Should the philosophy of religion be involved or detached? Inside or outside? Philosophy of religion is not religion. You can't do religion and critically evaluate it at the same time, just as you can't fall in love and critically evaluate love at the same time. If Romeo starts psychoanalyzing his love, he stops loving Juliet. When you evaluate anything, you're outside it. When you do it, you're inside it. You can't be both. So here's our dilemma. The study from the outside seems like the only fair approach. It's neutral and unprejudiced. But religion's data is largely an inside affair, like love. And unless we have inside data, unless we have experience, we're bound to talk nonsense, like a 2-year-old talking about sex, or a tone-deaf person about music. But to speak from inside is not to be neutral and unprejudiced. The lover is not neutral and unprejudiced about his love. He shouldn't be if he's a real lover. Neither is the believer unprejudiced about his religion, and he shouldn't be. By the way, I use the generic he not because I think men are in any way more human than women, but because I'm a man. If I were a woman, I'd use the generic she. So please don't be offended. Somehow, we need to combine both approaches. Without the outside approach, we have no clarity or objectivity or logical proof. Without the inside approach, we have no data, no experience, only empty words. Does that mean we have to be religious believers and practitioners to do the philosophy of religion? No. But I think it means we need at least some imaginative empathy, just as the believer needs to have some empathy to understand atheism. We all need to listen before we talk back. And that's something both good religion and good philosophy tell us to do. I think an examination of our initial spontaneous attitudes towards religion might reveal something useful. Let's begin there. Here are 4 statements about religion, not the vague, abstract, generic concept of religion in general, but whatever concrete, particular religion you know best, you were brought up in, you believe, or you once believed and you now disbelieve, which of these four statements do you identify with? Number one, this religion is the most important source of truth and goodness. Truth for your mind about life's most important questions, and goodness for your life and your moral choices and your personality. Religion makes you wise and good. Let's call people who check answer number one the believers, or the traditionalists. Number two, it is the world's greatest illusion and con job. The thing most people believe is the number one source of truth and goodness, but which really is not that at all, but is the number one source of superstition and oppression. Let's call people who check this answer the unbelievers, or the radicals. Number three, it is an illusion, or a superstition, or a myth rather than truth, if you take it literally, or too seriously, but it's still a good thing for your life, because it makes you better and happier. God is a sort of a good Santa Claus myth for grown-ups. It's not true, but it's good, because it makes you good. Let's call people who check this answer the revisionists, or modernists, or demythologizers. Number four, it's none of the above. It's simply not interesting, not an issue. Let's call people who check this answer the indifferent. I think if everyone took this test, it would show two striking differences between our modern Western culture and all other cultures in history. One of the differences is obvious. There are fewer believers in the West today, especially in Europe, and more unbelievers and revisionists than in almost any past culture. But a second difference, I think, is even more significant. In most past cultures, you could find some unbelievers and some revisionists, but hardly ever any of the indifferent, especially among the thinkers, the educated, the intelligentsia. But in our culture, indifference is probably the majority view of the thinkers. Perhaps that was the category you yourself checked, though probably not, since you were at least interested enough to listen to these lectures. But you probably know many people who would check that category, especially if you live in the blue states, in large cities, or near universities. Yet religion has traditionally been the least indifferent thing, the most passionate thing in human life, the thing martyrs die for, the thing saints live for, and the thing the most fanatical wars have been fought over. It is the most controversial topic in the world. If you want to turn a friendly dinner party into a battlefield, start arguing religion. Why is religion so controversial? Because people are passionate about it. But why are people so passionate about it? Because it's so interesting. Probably its only rival is sex and romance. Why is it so interesting? Because the questions it claims to answer are so interesting. For instance, how can I find joy? What is ultimate reality? What happens at death? And its answers, whether true or false, whether liberating or oppressive, are surprising. For instance, that you find joy by dying to the desire for it, or that ultimate reality is a single being so real that it is indefinable, or that death is your opportunity for supreme life in consummating your life's courtship with this being. That might be a great big fairy tale or a great big truth, but how could anyone find these claims small or boring? But we still haven't solved our dilemma about method. Is there any method that fulfills the demands of both the outside approach and the inside approach? I think there is. In one word, listening. If we begin with the outside approach, listening will send us to our data, to listen carefully to it, and to the religious believer, and to the critic, and to the saint and the mystic, to listen to their passion, to empathize, to try to enter into their experience imaginatively as best we can. If we do not listen respectfully and non-judgmentally before we begin to judge and evaluate and argue, we will have no data about religion. We'll have only words. And it's the logical and objective and scientific approach that demands this listening, this attention to data. That's the basic rule of fairness in any conversation, to be a good listener. That's precious, and unfortunately it's also rare. The inside approach also demands listening, because every religion in the world tells us to listen. To God, wherever he speaks, or to whatever is the ultimate reality, even if it's not called God, and to listen to our own deepest selves and to each other, and to listen to justice and reason as well as faith. Silence and listening are the only soil that religious plants can grow in. All the saints and sages and mystics say that, all the prophets and prayers of all the religions. Listening to the other is an act of mental unselfishness. Every religion in the world declares war on our natural selfishness and egotism and narrowness and prejudice and self-righteousness. The saints of every religion are strikingly similar there. Their creeds look strikingly different, but their souls look strikingly similar. And saints are religion's best-selling points. It seems only fair to judge a company by its best products, though listening to all the data demands that we listen to its worst products too. Listening doesn't contradict talking back, asking questions, and being critical. Those are two parts of the same thing, honesty. And these two parts of honesty have proved to be humanity's two most powerful instruments for finding truth in every field, from understanding people to understanding the universe. First listen, then talk back. Well then, when we do this talking back, when we do this critical questioning, how do we do it? Is there a method? Is there a structure? Yes, there is. It's called logic. Basic logic tells us to demand three things of any argument: clear definitions of terms, true premises, true data, and logically consistent proofs. And the rules of logic apply always and everywhere, in every field. There is no such thing as religious logic, any more than there is any such thing as nuclear logic or musical logic or Japanese logic or sexual logic. If you argue that electrons can change orbits instantaneously and whatever can do that disobeys the laws of Newtonian physics, therefore electrons disobey the laws of Newtonian physics, you have proved your conclusion, if you have clear definitions and true premises. And if you argue that music is powerful and everything powerful is dangerous, therefore music is dangerous, that is a logical argument. And if you can define your terms and be sure your premises are true, you have proved your conclusion. Just as if you argue that Zen meditation reveals the emptiness of yourself, and whatever reveals the emptiness of the self is the solution to the puzzle of the self, therefore Zen meditation is the solution to the puzzle of the self, that is a logical argument. And if the terms are clear and the premises are true, you have proved your conclusion. The rules of logic do not change when we insert religion into the content. What is illogical is simply unintelligible. If you say that God can perform not just miracles but contradictions, such as making good to be evil and evil to be good, if you say that God can really violate not just physical laws but logical laws, you have not said anything that has any meaning at all. A set of words that has no possible meaning to any human mind, like the sentence good is evil, does not suddenly acquire meaning when you add four more words to it: God can do this. What I've just said about logic and religion is not a religious or anti-religious opinion that some people believe and other people disbelieve. It is a self-evident truism, like 2 + 2 = 4. And I think no one can disagree with it if only they understand what it means. But though the laws of logic must apply to religion, what about the laws of other, more specific methods that we have found useful in other fields, such as the scientific method? Clearly, it would be unfair to argue, as one famous atheist did, that God does not exist because I cannot find him in my test tube. You cannot find your own mind there either. You can only find chemicals there. And the word God does not mean some chemical. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the scientific method, but that doesn't mean there aren't other good methods too. And to say that we should believe only what can be proved by the scientific method is self-contradictory, for that principle, that we should believe only what can be proved by the scientific method, cannot be proved by the scientific method. But we might be able to use some parts of the scientific method in religion, though not others. One of the most important steps of the scientific method is called universal methodic doubt. It means beginning not with unquestioned assumptions, but with doubt. Subject everything to question. Assume nothing, demand proof of everything. This principle is very useful not only in the hard sciences, but elsewhere, for instance, in detective work or in practical politics, or perhaps even in philosophy. Descartes tried it. So perhaps it is also useful for philosophizing about religion. But it will not be appropriate if religion is more like getting to know another person than it is like getting to know a concept or a material thing, or the sum total of all material things that we call the universe. You can't get to know people if you assume that everything they say is false until they prove it's true. The best method for understanding people is methodic faith rather than methodic doubt. Assume innocence until you prove guilt. Assume that the other person is telling the truth until you have good reason for believing that they are ignorant or lying. So, if religion is more like friendship with another person than it is like physics, then the appropriate method will be methodic faith rather than methodic doubt. Methodic faith is still critical. It's not naive. Socrates used the method of methodic faith in philosophy. He assumed that the other person was right until proved wrong. Then he went on to prove almost everybody wrong about almost everything. Perhaps we will end up doing the same to religion, perhaps not. But in either case, I think our method should be neither universal methodic doubt nor naive, unquestioning belief, but universal methodic faith followed by critical questioning. And another word for universal methodic faith is listening. There's one other part of the scientific method called Occam's razor, from William of Ockham, a 13th century British philosopher, that says hypotheses should not be multiplied without necessity. In other words, always prefer the simpler explanation. If you can explain Nazi Germany by economic depression and resentment at losing World War I, then don't bring in concepts like fate or predestination or historical necessity or the will of God. If you can explain insanity by a chemical imbalance in the brain, don't bring in the soul or evil spirits. So this principle has been very useful in the sciences. But doesn't it lead to atheism? If everything we find in our experience, everything we think about in the natural and the human sciences can be explained without God, doesn't God violate Occam's razor? And I think the answer is in science, yes, but in philosophy, no. Just as your shaving razor is useful for your face but not for your head, I think Occam's razor is useful for science but not for philosophy. It excludes too much data. Not all data is scientific data. For instance, is love only animal appetite? Is thought only cerebral biochemistry? Is man only a clever ape? This kind of reductionism, reducing the complex to the simple, may be good science, but it's bad philosophy. It's like laser light, powerful but narrow, more focused but less wide. And there's also a logical problem in using reductionism to exclude religion. The formula for reductionism is that A is nothing but B. Now, how do you know there's nothing more in A than B? Do you know absolutely all of A? Are you infallible? Aren't you assuming a knowledge only God can have? If only God can have such knowledge and you claim to have it, aren't you assuming that there is a God, namely you? There may be some good reasons for believing in the more complex explanations that religion offers, and you can't discount those reasons just by saying that you should always use the simplest possible explanation. You have to listen to all sides. And that's certainly not unscientific. In fact, the most important of all principles of science, even more important than Occam's razor, is the principle that all hypotheses are to be tested by the data. Gathering data, looking at all the data, listening to the data is essential. And if Occam's razor prevents us from doing that, then it is not scientific. We still haven't defined religion. I've been putting off that task because it's rather dull, but it's also necessary. So here we go. I shall make it as short as I can, like a dentist. To define the philosophy of religion, we have to define religion and philosophy. I said earlier that I couldn't define religion clearly, so let's settle for a description. A definition gives the essence, a description gives a property. One of the properties of all religions is faith. Every religion asks you to believe something that you can't see and can't prove. But this is still not specific enough. I believe I will wake up tomorrow morning, and I believe there are no men on Mars, and I believe the Red Sox deserved to crush the Yankees in 2004. But these are not religious beliefs. They're only opinions. Religious belief is called faith. People aren't usually willing to die for their opinions, but they're often willing to die for their faith. Opinions aren't lived 24 hours a day, but faith is. The object of a mental opinion or belief is a mere idea. The object of a religious faith is more than an idea. The object of religious faith is God or gods or nirvana or Tao, not just the idea of God or the idea of nirvana. In fact, all the religions claim that there is no adequate idea of God or nirvana or Tao or whatever it calls the ultimate reality. Nirvana is not this, not that. The Tao that can be told is not the real Tao. Only God knows who God is. The religious claim is not that we know God, but that God knows us. Philosophy is a bit easier to define. Philosophy of religion is a subdivision of philosophy, and philosophy means the love of wisdom. Wisdom is not just knowledge, but understanding. And understanding not just things like languages and animals and geometry, things we can all see and learn about scientifically and commonsensically, but things like human nature and moral values and the purpose of human life, if there is any, and the ultimate reality or the ultimate explanation for all reality or something like God. And since all religions claim to tell us something interesting and important about human nature and moral values and the purpose of human life and the nature of ultimate reality or God, therefore there is a natural interface between philosophy and religion in subject matter, even though there's a sharp distinction in method. Philosophy uses only reason, not faith. It critiques faith. It evaluates faith, as it evaluates everything else, by reason. So we had better define reason, too, because there are broader and narrower meanings that often get confused. I think Socrates and Descartes and Kant are the three thinkers who most importantly change the meaning of the concept reason, all narrowing it in different ways. So we can distinguish four meanings of reason, increasingly narrow as they get increasingly modern: the pre-Socratic, the Socratic, the Cartesian, and the Kantian. Before Socrates, reason meant everything that distinguished man from animals, including intuition, mystical experiences, and dreams. Socrates narrowed it to mean giving clear definitions and logical proofs. Socrates really invented logic about 2,400 years ago. Then, about 400 years ago, Descartes narrowed it further to mean something more like the scientific method, even in philosophy. The act of calculating, reasoning, proving, rather than wisdom or understanding. Something we all have an equal ability to do, rather than something like wisdom that some of us have more of than others. Finally, Kant psychologized reason. He said that our reason constructs or shapes the world rather than discovering it, so it can't know things as they are in themselves. We can't know objective reality by reason. Now, that's a terribly simplified history of Western philosophy in 1 minute, but I give it to you not for the history, but for the clarification of our definition of reason. I will use reason in the way most people still use it, in the Socratic way. Mystical experience or dreams or intuition or myths will not count as reason, even though all may contain great wisdom and profound value, but only what is definable and provable. But I won't narrow the term any more than that. I won't identify philosophical reason with scientific reason or reduce reason to calculation, as Descartes did, and I won't assume that reason can never know objective reality, as Kant did, because that would really reduce philosophy to psychology. Now, you don't have to agree or disagree with Socrates or Descartes or Kant. I'm just telling you how I will use the word reason in these lectures, especially when I talk about the relation between religious faith and philosophical reason. So let's talk about that right now. What is the relation between faith and reason? I don't mean the relation between the act of believing and the act of reasoning in our minds. That's for the psychologist. I mean the logical relation between the ideas believed and the ideas reasoned to. Put all that is believed by religious faith into propositions, declarative sentences, and do the same with all that is known by reason alone, without any religious faith. Now, put each of these lists of propositions into a class, and imagine each class as a circle. One circle contains all the things religion teaches and claims to be true and invites us to believe. The other circle contains all the things we can define and prove by reason. Now, our question is, how are these two circles related to each other? Do they overlap totally, or a lot, or a little, or not at all? Can reason define and/or prove everything, most things, only a few things, or no things that are believed by religious faith? That's one question. And here's a second one. Are there any propositions in one circle that contradict any propositions in the other? Do faith and reason, do religion and logic contradict each other? We don't have time to look at the truth claims of every religion, so for practical purposes in these lectures, we'll concentrate about 80% of the time on the common beliefs of the three most familiar religions in our culture, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And about 10% of the time we'll broaden out to include Eastern religions, especially Hinduism and Buddhism, and about 10% of the time focus more specifically on Christianity. There's no one standard answer among Jewish, Christian, or Muslim philosophers to the question of how much of religious faith can be proved by reason. The most popular and traditional answer is not all of it, for then faith would not be necessary, and not none of it, for then philosophy of religion would be impossible, but some of it. For instance, in the Middle Ages, Maimonides, Aquinas, and Avicenna all argued that reason can prove the existence of God, but not his choices and purposes, and that reason can prove the existence of life after death, but not many of the details of it. But what about the more important question? Are there any contradictions between faith and reason? No Orthodox Jew, Christian, or Muslim can admit that there are any. Because if God created us in his image, and reason is part of that image, then when we use that instrument rightly, we're being taught by God. Just as when we interpret the divinely revealed scriptures rightly, we're being taught by God. And God never contradicts himself. Therefore, there can never be any real contradictions between religious faith and reason. If there were, then reason would have disproved that part of religious faith, so an honest person would no longer believe it. So either the religion can be proved to be false, or there are no contradictions between faith and reason. So it is crucial for a religious believer, who is also a philosophical thinker, to show that there are no such contradictions. Only a schizophrenic or a hypocrite can believe on Sunday what he disbelieves on Monday. Therefore, our next topic will be to explore the claim that there are such contradictions, to explore the arguments against religious belief, the case for atheism, or the falsity of all religion. Atheism is the simplest answer to all the puzzles of the philosophy of religion. It claims that all the puzzles are there because religion is a dream or a nightmare, and that reason can wake us up from that bad dream. We will explore 20 arguments for that position in the next lecture.
This ends Lecture 1. Questions of Faith, Lecture 2, Atheism.
Most people don't decide whether to believe in God or not to believe by objectively and logically comparing the arguments for atheism with the arguments for theism. Some believers can give good reasons, but most probably believe mainly because their families or friends do. There's probably a larger percentage of unbelievers than believers who can give good reasons, because in our culture, religious belief is still the more popular position, so the unbeliever, as the rebel, usually has to think more independently. But many atheists, too, and people who once believed and no longer do, don't give reasons. They just drift away rather than reasoning their way into atheism. Is it irresponsible to make the biggest decision of your life by something less clear than reason? Or is that quite natural and proper? Should the believer accept the onus of proof, the demand to give reasons for his faith, or does the unbeliever have the onus of proof to disprove the believer? Unbelievers usually say the believer has the onus of proof, like the salesperson who comes to your door. He has to prove his product is worth buying. You, the skeptical customer, don't have to prove your skepticism. Some believers agree with this, but others say that it's silly to try to decide a thing as big as a religion by an objective, logical comparison of arguments for both sides. That's like deciding whether to marry somebody or not in that way. I am not an atheist, but I have to agree with the unbeliever here, and that's why I will be giving you a lot of reasons for both sides and evaluating them. Let's use the term atheism to mean simply the belief that no God exists, and theism to mean the belief that some sort of God exists, whether that belief is arrived at by reason or by faith or both. Since most people are not atheists but theists, we should begin by looking at the arguments for atheism. If most people were atheists, we would begin by looking at the arguments for theism. But isn't a lecture on atheism in a course on the philosophy of religion something like a physics teacher spending his first lecture exploring the claim of some Hindus and Buddhists that matter doesn't exist, that it is an illusion, a dream, Maya? Well, yes, it is. And if you were teaching physics in India rather than in the West, that's probably how you ought to begin, because many of your students will disbelieve in matter, but not many will disbelieve in God. In the West, it's just the opposite. Atheism is a live option in the West. And it's attractively simple. If it's true, all the problems in the philosophy of religion are solved, or dumped into the lap of the psychologist or the psychiatrist instead of the philosopher. I begin with atheism also because I think the theist has to accept the onus of proof. Persons should be judged innocent till proved guilty, but ideas should be judged guilty till proved innocent, as long as you don't limit your proofs to absolutely clear and certain proofs. And while religion deals with God as a person, the philosophy of religion deals with the idea of God. So I think it's right to demand proof of the idea that God exists. But the atheist has to give reasons too, at least in a religious society like ours, in which most people believe God does exist. If you are an atheist and you want to help people to find the truth, you have to take their religious beliefs seriously to begin with and try to refute them, and therefore you have to give reasons for your atheism. You can't just assume atheism and challenge theists to prove God exists. You won't get anywhere that way. It won't work. You have to give reasons for your atheism, just as believers have to give reasons for their faith. And if you are a religious believer and you're trying to change the mind of your atheist friend, it won't work for you simply to assume the existence of God and challenge the atheist to refute it. So the answer to our question of whether we should begin by assuming that God doesn't exist or by assuming that God does exist is neither. Both sides have to give reasons. So we start with the atheist. Here are the 20 reasons most often given by atheists for not believing there is any kind of God, and therefore that all religion is fundamentally false, because all religion is based on the claim that there is something like a God. Of course, there is much more to religion than that, but if that's not true, if there is nothing like God, then religion is fundamentally untrue. And this has consequences. If there's no God, then there's no human soul made in the image of God, and no immortality of a soul, no life after death, no heaven or hell, no salvation from one to the other, etc. This is true even of Buddhism, which does not teach a God or a soul, but is totally silent about God and explicitly denies the existence of the individual soul and even the collective soul or Atman. But there is an absolute, Nirvana. Buddha mind, only mind, one mind, cosmic consciousness. And if that's not true, then nothing else in Buddhism makes sense either. For there is no point to meditation or the whole Noble Eightfold Path. The path has nowhere to go. There is no reason to change your consciousness through religious meditation if ordinary consciousness and the ordinary secular self and world is all that there is. Now, Christianity and Buddhism are very different religions, but whichever is right, whether God and the soul are to be found or to be transcended, whether the end is salvation from sin or from suffering, whether the goal is God and heaven or nirvana and enlightenment, in either case, if the golden castle at the end of the road isn't there, nothing on the road makes sense. The castle is what we've called something like God, and the road is religion. Atheism claims, first of all, that the God of the three major Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, does not exist, but it also says that all religions are false. We will focus on the two sides of the debate in Western culture in this lecture, just to make things shorter and simpler and more practical, because that's what most people in our culture are interested in. Here, very briefly, are 20 arguments for atheism given by Western philosophers. They're of two basic kinds. The first kind is logical and scientific arguments. The second kind is psychological arguments. First, by far the strongest and simplest and most popular argument for atheism is the problem of evil. When theists say God exists, they don't mean a God like Zeus, who is limited in goodness and in power, but the God of the Bible, who is unlimitedly good and unlimitedly powerful. A God who is infinitely good wills only good, and a God who is infinitely powerful gets whatever he wills. His good meets no obstacle, has no limits. So if such an infinite God existed, there would be no room for his opposite, evil. But evil is real. Therefore, such a God cannot exist. This argument is so strong and so important that we will spend the entire next lecture examining it. It is the most difficult one for theists to answer. The other 19 arguments for atheism have less ambitious claims. The argument from evil claims to logically disprove the existence of God with certainty, claims that belief in God's existence can be proved to be false. The other arguments only claim to show that belief in God is unnecessary, uncertain, improbable, thoughtless, unscientific, childish, irresponsible, easily explainable, problematic, immoral, harmful, unhappy, or pathological. They only claim to seriously weaken and cripple religious belief. The argument from evil claims to kill it. Well, a second common argument is that God is an unnecessary hypothesis, like UFOs or Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. Even if you can't prove there is no such being, you can explain everything without him. Everything in nature can be explained by natural forces without anything supernatural, and everything in human life can be explained by human beings, human minds and wills, without anything supernatural. Maybe you can't prove there is no God, but if you can't prove there is, then it's as irresponsible and silly to believe in God as to believe in the real existence of Harvey, the invisible giant rabbit that Jimmy Stewart keeps talking to in that old movie classic. Occam's razor tells us to use the simplest explanations rather than needlessly multiply hypotheses, and Occam's razor shaves away the hair of religion. Third, all the theists' arguments for the existence of God can be answered. Each of them has a weak point, an ambiguous term or a false assumption or a logical fallacy. We will explore 20 arguments for the existence of God in two lectures coming up, but the atheist claims he has a reply to every single one of them, just as the theist claims he has an answer to each of these 20 arguments for atheism. By the way, a basic rule of logical debate is that you have to do both. Give positive arguments of your own, and also show where each of your opponent's arguments is weak by finding an ambiguity, a false assumption, or a logical fallacy in each one. Those are the three checkpoints of any argument, the only three possible logical weak points in any argument. You see, logic is like sports or war. You have to have both offense and defense. So the atheist has to show weaknesses in each of the theist's arguments, as well as giving positive arguments of his own for atheism. And the theist has to show weaknesses in each of the atheist's arguments, as well as giving positive arguments of his own for the existence of God. A fourth argument for atheism is this: we test theories by how much they can explain. Atheism explains more than theism, because the atheist can explain the theist, better than the theist can explain the atheist. On the assumption that there is no God, the atheist can explain religious belief better than the theist can explain disbelief. For if this wonderful God were real, why wouldn't everyone want to believe in him? It's like a fairy tale or Santa Claus. People stop believing in Santa Claus only for one reason, because they grow up and learn the facts. But it was fun when we believed in Santa Claus, and it made us happy, and it even made us good, made us behave very well around Christmas time. So why would the atheist give up religion unless he grew up and learned enough facts to refute it? We become tough-minded instead of tender-minded when we grow up. If atheism is an illusion, the theist has no explanation for this illusion. But if theism is an illusion, the atheist has a very good explanation for that. It's Freud's explanation. Wishful thinking. The idea of God is very comforting. Once we realize our human father is mortal, we lose all the comfort that he gave us. There's two basic kinds of comfort he gave us, and those are the two things we want the most, intellectual and emotional comfort, truth and happiness. We got intellectual comfort from trusting that Daddy knew all the answers, that he knew more than we did about this mysterious world and this mysterious life. Every little kid finds the world and life mysterious. And we got emotional comfort from trusting Daddy. He would protect us from dangerous things in this world, like robbers or poverty or diseases or bullies. But once we realize Daddy's going to die, we just have to believe that there is an invisible, immortal Big Daddy in the sky. Otherwise, we would go insane with anxiety. Our unconscious mind then finds reasons to convince our conscious mind to believe this. But the reasons are all rationalizations. Our desires are much stronger than our reason. We want happiness more than we want logic, so we believe what we want to believe, what we need to believe, if we're going to be happy. Religion is a comforting illusion, especially in the face of death. That's a pretty convincing explanation. The theist, on the other hand, on the assumption that God is not real, can't explain how the illusion of atheism arose in the mind of the atheist, at least not as well as the atheist can explain how the illusion of God arose in the mind of the theist. The theist's explanation is usually that the atheist is either very stupid or very wicked. But why would anyone want to deny God if God is real and such a comfort? Only if he wants power. Only if he's wicked. He's a rebel who will sacrifice both truth and happiness to be number one. In other words, only if he's a proud and arrogant sinner. But atheists reply, we atheists are no more proud or arrogant or sinful than religious people. In fact, isn't it humbler and less proud and arrogant to claim that you don't know God than that you do? And atheists certainly aren't stupider than most people. They tend to be smarter, better educated, more logical, and more scientific. We could call the four above arguments logical arguments, and the next four scientific arguments. The scientific method is by far the most reliable method we have ever found for finding truth. In fact, it's the only method which has ever succeeded in giving us certainty, in convincing everyone. That's why scientists don't keep disagreeing and arguing forever, like philosophers and politicians and religious people. They have found a method of resolving and ending their disagreements, and that is the scientific method. But religion does not survive the scientific method. If we use the scientific method to test religion, we will not be able to verify religion any more than we will be able to verify Santa Claus or Bigfoot. That is argument number five. This argument does not claim to prove that atheism is true, as the problem of evil does, but simply that there is no good reason to believe in God. We probably can't prove that Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or Little Green Men don't exist either, but we have no good reason for thinking they do. So the reasonable attitude is not to believe. There's two kinds of unbelievers, atheists and agnostics. Atheists say that they know God does not exist. Agnostics say they don't know. They say there is no adequate reason for believing that God does exist. Well, the problem of evil claims to prove atheism. This argument claims to prove agnosticism. So does the previous argument that all the arguments for theism have weaknesses. Our next argument, argument number six, claims not just that theism can't be proved, but that theism is meaningless, because it makes no definable difference. The theist can't specify what in the world would be different if theism is or is not true. What evidence could conceivably verify or falsify theism? Here are two concrete examples of the scientific argument for agnosticism in the form of two stories. One is from my own life, and one is from a famous article called Gods by an atheist philosopher named John Wisdom. My pious aunt had come back home to New Jersey from Chicago by train, and she had taken an earlier train instead of the one she had a ticket for. The train she had a ticket for had an accident, and many people were injured. So she said, "See, that proves that there's a God watching over me." I asked her, "If you had taken the other train and you had been injured, would that have proved that there isn't a God, or that he wasn't watching over you?" She had no answer, of course. Whether she was right in her trust in God or not, she was certainly not right in her logic. Religion can't be verified or falsified, proved or disproved by any data. No matter what happens, religious believers will interpret it religiously. If terrible things happen, that's God's justice. If they stop happening, that's God's mercy. No data, no experiment can in principle disprove a religious faith. That makes this faith logically meaningless. It's like saying, "You are Jesus Christ." I ask, "Why don't you perform miracles then to prove yourself?" And you answer, "Jesus didn't perform miracles just to prove himself either." "Well, why don't you heal this poor blind man then, not to prove yourself, but out of compassion?" "Well, because Jesus didn't heal all the blind men in the world either." "Why not? Hey, if I'm God, I don't have to give you my reasons. You're only human. Why should you be able to understand God?" "But if you're Jesus, why doesn't the world worship you?" "Well, they didn't worship him either, because they were sinful and stupid." "I think you're a lunatic." "Of course you do. That's exactly what sinful and stupid people think about God." Here is a famous parable by the atheist John Wisdom. Two philosophers walking through the country find an apparently abandoned garden full of weeds. One says, "There is an invisible gardener who has good reasons for not tending his garden." The other sees this belief as irrational because there is no evidence, no amount of weeds that could ever possibly disprove it. The first philosopher is the theist, the second is the atheist or the agnostic, and it's the second who's obviously more reasonable. A seventh argument is that the atheist can appeal to the historical fact that science has gradually replaced religion throughout human history, because science explains more and more of what we used to think was supernatural by its increasing knowledge of natural laws. We used to think there must be a god like Zeus to explain thunder and lightning. Now we know what causes it. The more we know about science, the less we believe in miracles. The more we know about natural causes, the less need and the less reason to believe in supernatural causes. The argument can go on to claim even more that science has disproved miracles because miracles contradict natural laws, and natural laws are the most certain things we know. Another scientific argument, number 8, focuses on a specific discovery of science, evolution, which shows that the human species evolved gradually from inferior species by random chance and natural selection. And this contradicts the religious belief in creation, which claims that we were created, suddenly and miraculously, by a superior being out of deliberate, intelligent design. Are we made in the image of King God or King Kong? The two theories contradict each other. And there is massive scientific evidence for evolution and none for creation. A ninth argument, if the theist argues for a creator from evidence in the visible world, the atheist replies that most of the evidence in the visible world counts against theism. The universe is far more full of emptiness and waste and injustice and chance and disorder and suffering than it is full of their opposites. Why all those empty eons before man evolved? Why all that space, all those galaxies, all those wasted fish eggs? All the bloody competition for survival, all the animals that had to die for man to evolve. The universe does not seem to be a very hospitable place. It's far less comfortable, less hospitable, more terrifying, more indifferent, less man-centered than religion thinks. We are not at the center, as they used to think in the Middle Ages. How can you look at the real world at nature red in tooth and claw and say this is evidence for a wise, good, loving, benevolent God who created man in his own image as the apple of his eye? Another argument from science, number 10, is this. Belief in God usually goes with belief in a spiritual soul, which is immortal. So denial of God usually goes together with denial of this immortal soul or spirit. When science believed in spirits, it didn't work. Only when science became materialistic did it start to work. Only when we stopped looking for angels that supposedly moved the planets did we discover celestial mechanics and gravity. Only when we stopped looking for the soul did we learn how to perform brain surgery. In other words, in two words, materialism works. Materialism also works logically, and that's argument number 11. There is no supposedly spiritual event that can't be explained materially. Your brain is a computer. If you remove parts of it, you can't do math. Remove other parts and you can't make moral choices. Remove other parts and you can't pray or have religious experiences. Everything that used to be believed to exist in the spiritual column can be explained by something very specific and identifiable in the material column. So it looks suspiciously as if the whole spiritual column is simply a mirror image erected by scientific ignorance. Another argument, we're up to number 12. There are no logical contradictions in science, but there are many logical contradictions within religion. For instance, in Buddhism, the mystic discovers that the self does not exist. The self discovers its own non-existence. You need a real self to make that real discovery. And in Western religions, God is perfect, and everything he does is perfect, and yet he creates a very imperfect world. And God is just, which means punishing the guilty, but God is also merciful, which means not punishing. In Christianity, he is one and three at the same time, and Jesus is divine and human at the same time, immortal and mortal, all-powerful and vulnerable. Logically, it can't be both. Here's argument number 13. There are also contradictions between any two religions in the world. And since both of two contradictory beliefs can't be true, there must be falsehoods in every religion, or else only one is totally true and all the rest which contradict it have falsehoods. But every religion claims some form of perfection, infallibility, divine revelation. No religion says it is only a fallible human hypothesis which may be false. Therefore, all but one of the world's religions must contain falsity, for they all contradict each other, and most probably all contain falsity. For when 10 people all claim they saw a ghost, but all 10 contradict each other about the ghost, it's most likely that there's no ghost at all, and they're all deceived or hallucinating or making it up. This leads to a 14th argument against all religions, a psychological one this time. Religion does us harm because it is arrogant and fanatical. It does harm to the mind because it closes the mind and deceives you into thinking you have certainty when you don't. And it does harm to others because if you believe you have the absolute truth, you'll probably make yourself a preachy pest, if not a terrorist, and try to make other people believe what you believe. Religion narrows the range of human thought and behavior. You must not think heretical thoughts that contradict your religion's claims to truth, and you must not behave in any way not approved by your religion's moral code. Religion restricts your mind and your life. It oppresses you. It does not liberate humanity. It is that from which humanity needs to be liberated. It makes you an unfree conformist to a divine tyrant. It makes you feel humble and small and smarmy in the presence of Oz the Great and Terrible, helpless in the presence of omnipotence, stupid in the presence of omniscience, sinful and dirty in the presence of perfect holiness. Religion doesn't liberate you, it enslaves you. You're not free to create your own values. You have to accept your marching orders from General God because you've been drafted into his army without your choice by the fact of your birth. Religion doesn't save you, it kills you. It does to your self-esteem what smoking does to your lungs. It's carcinogenic. Now, psychological attacks like this don't claim the kind of certainty or proof that scientific arguments do, but they probably have a lot more power. People are motivated most strongly by the changes in their life that they see as consequences of believing religious ideas, rather than by the strength of the objective logical reasons for believing them. So even though psychological arguments like this one don't have the proof power of scientific arguments, we should consider this kind of argument too, on both sides, atheist and theist. But should we decide what to believe by looking at the perceived consequences in our lives? William James has a famous essay called The Will to Believe, where he argues that we should. W.K. Clifford, author of Clifford's Rule, argues that we shouldn't. That's a question we'll have to look at in a later lecture on the epistemology of religion. Epistemology is that division of philosophy that investigates the process of human knowing, how it works and how it ought to work, and what justifies us when we say that we know something. Here is a 15th argument for atheism. Suppose the theist uses the psychological kind of argument and says you should believe in some religion because it makes you better and not worse, and because it makes you more like a saint, makes you behave better, makes you good. Almost nobody can deny that it's good to be good. So the atheist must reply that religion doesn't make you good, it makes you goody-goody. It doesn't make you righteous, it makes you self-righteous. We're now arguing about whether religion's consequences are good or bad. And the atheist argues that by religion's own standards, they are bad. Religion is self-contradictory in practice, even if not in theory. Religion condemns self-righteousness and hypocrisy and Phariseeism, but religion naturally produces these moral fakes. Religion supposedly exists to make saints out of sinners, but religion itself labels us as sinners. Saints are religion's best products, but saints are very rare, the exception, not the rule. So religions are like fish. Most of their eggs die. If an auto manufacturer produced 99 lemons for every good car, would you buy a car from that company? So by its own standards, religion is a moral failure. I recommend two great novels that raise this issue. One is Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, especially the character of Ivan Karamazov. Ivan's argument for atheism, which is, I think, the most powerful and appealing in all of human literature, rests on the premise that if there is a God, he is unjust and deserves our rebellion, not our faith. His case is a moral case against God. The other great fictional atheist is Dr. Roux in Albert Camus' The Plague. Dr. Roux believes three things which are logically incompatible, but he can't deny any one of the three. So he is in this moral dilemma, this lived dilemma. First, there is no God. Second, you can't be a saint without God. Third, the whole meaning of human life is to be a saint. Some atheists would reply that his second of Dr. Roux's beliefs is wrong. You can be a saint without God. That's humanist atheism. Others, like Nietzsche and Freud, in different ways, would deny the third belief of Dr. Roux, that the meaning of life is to be a saint. A 16th argument is that religion has produced more harm than good, publicly and collectively and historically, as well as privately and individually. Religion has fueled and motivated most of the wars and the bitterest wars in human history. The deepest hatreds are religious. Today, this comes most obviously from Islamic terrorists. But whoever gets to the top, whoever gets the power, always seems to do the most harm. And religion has the most power. So religion harms the world the most. If religion produces the most wars and wars harm people the most by killing the most people, it logically follows that religion harms people the most. Another bad psychological effect of religion, and this would be argument 17, is guilt. The higher the standards that I believe I have to come up to, the worse I'll believe that I am. Religions don't just give us high ideals, they give us impossible laws. They give us something like Zen Buddhist koan puzzles. They're unsolvable. Jesus says, "You must be perfect as my Father in heaven is perfect." God says to his chosen people, the Jews, through the prophet Moses, "You must be holy as I, the Lord your God, am holy." The Quran insists on the straight path, the perfectly pure path, because Allah is perfectly pure. Nothing else is good enough. For Buddha, we are all in the dream of illusion unless we experience enlightenment or nirvana. For Jesus, we are all sinners doomed to hell unless we repent and believe. Religions all begin by insulting us, slapping us in the face, and making us feel hopeless. Then they offer themselves as the only cure. It's the old salesman's trick. First create an unreal artificial need in your sucker, then present yourself as the only one who can supply that need. You're going to die unless you buy my witch doctor magic healing ointment, and I'm the only one who sells it. Price, just your soul. It's really religion that gives us the devil's sales pitch. Sign this contract, give me your soul, and you can have this nice apple. Religion depends on the world's oldest profession, advertising. Another effect of having impossibly high ideals, and this would be argument number 18, is hypocrisy. We can't admit that we are as bad as religion tells us we are, so we pretend we're good. We pretend that we're fairly successful at being the saints that our religion tells us we have to be, otherwise we'd be in despair. So religion makes us lie to ourselves. Still another bad psychological effect of religion, this would be argument 19, comes from its belief in life after death. That becomes a diversion, a distraction from this world and all its joys and beauties and possibilities. Religion depresses the value of this life and this world for the sake of the next. Religion makes you a traitor to this world. It says the world is a sinking ship, but there's a lifeboat. Come with us, desert the ship, become a rat. Take your money out of this world's bank, invest in eternity. And we control those banks, trust us. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but lose his own soul? In other words, if you really believe in God and heaven, how can you care much about this world? If you're going to buy a big, beautiful mansion and plan to live in it someday, how much interest will you now have in your old, crummy little apartment that you still live in? Will you take more care of it or less? Similarly, religion ignores or puts down or condemns the body for the sake of the soul. And this would be argument number 20. But most of our pleasures are bodily pleasures. Religion tells us to give them up. They all condemn greed and lust, in other words, money and sex. Why? If all religious believers suddenly became convinced that there was no God, no heaven, and no hell, how would that change their lives? You know the answer to that. They'd probably go out and make all the money they possibly could and have all the sex they possibly could with all the people they possibly could, without guilt or scruple or repression. In other words, they'd have a lot of fun. What stops them? One thing above all, their belief in God's frown and wagging finger. So, the key to fun is atheism. Well, how shall we decide this issue? Both sides argue, and often argue well and intelligently. Neither side is simply stupid. They've both got good arguments. We'll see the other side in a moment. But one side must be very importantly wrong. Now, if one side was obviously stupid, we could easily find the truth. But they're not. And if the issue wasn't so important, we wouldn't have to worry about it. But it is. Both sides agree about that. Religion is either mankind's greatest truth or greatest error. So we just have to plunge in and look ourselves, honestly and carefully, at all the arguments and all the answers and all the evidence. And above all, we have to search honestly, for if modern psychology has taught us anything, it has taught us that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. And I think we even have to search passionately, because the more important the issue is, the less easy it is to solve. The most important truths are like deer. They hide in the bushes. They don't come out into the easy, sunny public places. So if you want them, you have to hunt them down. There's not much in the philosophy of religion that atheists and theists can agree on, but I think they would both strongly agree with the following teaching of religious sages like Jesus and Buddha and Socrates. Seek and you shall find. In other words, if you don't seek the truth, or don't seek it well, or don't seek it enough, you probably won't find it. The best way to find the truth is to seek it passionately and honestly, both objectively and subjectively, with all your mind and all your heart. In fact, that sounds like what Jesus called the first and greatest commandment. If Jesus is right about God, then someone who becomes an atheist because he has sought the truth with all his heart and mind and soul and strength has really sought God, if God is the ultimate truth. And again, if Jesus is right, all who seek find. So perhaps the passionately honest atheist is far more pleasing to God than the less honest and less passionate theist. And from the atheist's point of view, even if there is no God, and we ought to believe atheism, above all because that is the truth, then even the honest theist who seeks the truth but has not found it yet because he is not yet an atheist is more right than the dishonest atheist who does not seek the truth. We've briefly explored 20 popular arguments for atheism, but we haven't gone very deeply into the strongest and most important one, the problem of evil. Next lecture, that is exactly what we will do. We'll look at the atheist's strongest case, the problem of evil, and life's deepest mystery.
This ends Lecture 2.